And welcome back to the Sundance on the weekend Sundance Reel. I'm not quite sure what the name of this
Sundance
thing
on the weekends. Day four of the Sundance Film Festival
Sundance 2019. Sundance Reeling on the weekend.
Reeling in the weekend.
And I'm Rick Bruff with my co-host,
I'm John Burdick.
Mr. John Burdick, the hardest working man in show business.
At least in Park City, maybe.
And running the board is Monica, the hardest working woman in the radio business.
This hour, we've got some fun interviews that we're going to be going through. The first interview we will be with is a film called The Boy Who Harnessed the Wind. It's in the premiere category. And Chiwetel Ejiofor, is coming in. We have writer, co-director, and producer Andre Horman with a short animated documentary, Akiko Takakura, about the last remaining survivors of the atomic bomb. And then after that, we will have the film we'll be talking with. It's Toni Morrison. The Pieces I Am is the name of the film. And they'll be in talking with us. We have filmmaker, photographer Timothy Greenfield Sanders. And then final for the hour, the film is called Late Night. And in studio with us from Late Night is Nisha Gantara. Ganatra.
Yeah. In terms of John, for yourself, have you found your Sundance rhythm yet?
Yeah,
What pictures have you gotten to?
I've gotten in two a day. I've been kind of pacing myself this year. Documentary is always probably one of my favorite parts of this festival of going to see. And so I got to two documentaries yesterday. And I got to see Untouchable in the morning and then Inventor at night. So I kind of bookend my day there and two very interesting documentaries.
In common, kind of stories about people that were stars in their world and their rise and fall.
Yes, exactly.
Silicon Valley and Hollywood.
It very similar. And the funny thing is in both of those documentaries, a writer from The New Yorker appears. It's like, maybe next year we need to see a documentary about this particular writer from Ken. I can't think of his last name. He's a New Yorker editorialist that it was in both documentaries, which I thought was really ironic that my day started and ended with this guy talking about
the same talking head.
Exactly. And in two completely different, subject matters and documentary. What about you? What did you get to go see yesterday?
Well, let's see. The one most interesting one I went to was Leaving Neverland, which was the big binge of Michael Jackson and the stories of sexual abuse and the focus on two people who came forward to talk about Michael's abuse of them years after the abuse occurred and after he had gone to trial twice on
charges.
Alleged abuse of other boys and these two were the first incidents in the 90s they were witnesses on his behalf and they said no he didn't do anything to
right us. Well Corey Feldman was in I ran into him yesterday at the VR he was around with an entourage you couldn't miss him and we my wife and I were going and trying the VR at the New Frontier Central was amazing. And we got to go see a bunch of those exhibits, and he just wandered in while we were waiting for one of those.
Yeah, was he at that showing? Because Corey Feldman has brought that issue to the fore.
Yes.
A lot.
He was just wandering around, just, talking to people and being Corey Feldman.
Yeah, well, maybe that'll be the Sundance documentary next year, is being Corey Feldman.
Yes, I'm in pre-production with that right now. I'm talking to people, and my people will talk to some other people.
Okay, we'll take a little bit of a pause, and we'll be back with...
Honor some underwriters, and we'll be right back.
One of the actors and the director of The Boy Who Harnessed the Wind.
Hi, this is Guy Raz, host of the TED Radio Hour from NPR. Join me for the TED Radio Hour Sunday mornings at 10 right here on KPCW. Each episode takes you on a journey through the world of ideas with riveting speakers from the renowned TED stage. The show is the fastest-growing program in public radio history, and it's on Sundays at 10 a.m. on KPCW.
Brought to you in part by New Park Town Center with Crandall Capital and Lisa Lundquist, Veritas Funding, loving, living, lending the Park City lifestyle.
Yeah, just be exactly,
yeah. Welcome back to Sundance Reel on the weekends. In studio with us, Chuitel from The Boy Who Harnessed the Wind. Welcome to Utah. Welcome to Sundance.
Thank you. Great
GF4.
Yeah.
And we should note, in connection with Sundance, now he is best known as the lead of a film that won the Oscar for Best Picture, 12 Years a Slave. In terms of Sundance history, maybe even more fondly remembered because you were one of the leads of Kinky Boots, right?
That's true. Yeah.
Yeah. Lola, Lola. Okay, yeah.
As they scream down Main Street.
Yes. Did you visit Park City when that film premiered?
Yeah. We had a great time here. Absolutely amazing. You know, it was really great fun.
Yeah, and now you've branched out from being an actor to directing, and you also appear in this picture. But a boy,
yeah, star in the picture is the main character, so the father.
Well, is it? Were you always one of those guys who said, you know, I want to direct one day, or was the story itself that said made you want to?
It was the book. Yeah. It was the book that kind of changed everything. I read the book about 10 years ago when it came out, and I was just stunned by it, you know, and I felt like it would make an extraordinary film. I really wanted to, you know, just see if I could find a way to kind of get it out there, and so began the process of adapting the book, and then sort of brought producers on board and started to develop the story, and then at some point within that decided that it would be good. I found myself very inside the story. I'd been traveling back and forth to Malawi to meet the real William Kamkwamba and his family and to get to know that community a little bit better. And it suddenly started to make sense to direct the film as well at that point.
So did you film right there where he grew up?
We filmed right on the locations where he grew up, in the village he grew up in, and in all of the places that the events actually took place, you know. We filmed in his school, for example, is his real school, and you know, there's huge sections of the film and kind of the grain reserve areas, and you know, we filmed in all of those places, which was great. You know, the community, I suppose, when you're going into a community, it's like the circus comes to town. It's quite a remote area. And, you know, they really embraced it, and that made all the difference, you know. So all of the kind of challenges of being in somewhere which was quite remote and not, there wasn't really that much filming infrastructure, you know, no films of this scale really have been made in Malawi. So we were bringing in stuff from Johannesburg and Nairobi. And those challenges, logistical challenges, you know, just paled into insignificance compared to what we got from being there.
That the main character...
Exactly. For sure. The challenges that he actually faced in that time, William Kamkwamba.
Can you talk a little bit about the plot of the film? And then another question that just jumped in my head when you said circuses is, can you talk... The circus that comes to the funerals, can you...
Yeah, sure.
Let's start about the film's synopsis.
So the film is the Boy Who Harnessed the Wind is the story of William Kamkwamba, who when he was 13, in around 2001, 2002, his community suffered a terrible, tragic famine that arrived in that community, and so he was taken out of school. You know, education isn't free in Malawi, so he was taken out of secondary school because his parents couldn't afford to, and they sort of knuckled down and braced for the worst, and the whole community was devastated and affected. And within that time, he started to sneak into the school library and found a book, an American textbook called Using Energy, from that period. And on that book, there is a picture of a windmill in the front. And so going to the junkyard, he started to piece together, using sort of scrap metal and stuff that he could find, and using this book, he started to build a wind turbine, to build a windmill, so that he could power a water pump to irrigate the land.
Pretty amazing the way that just going, watching him go through the junkyards and seeing that type of poverty and lifestyle is and him just looking at it like, okay, this is life. This is how I'm going to solve this.
Yeah.
And then the between your character and him, just you being stuck in the old school way of this is never going to work. And
yeah, this sort of generational push and pull. I play his father, Triwell, and those are the dynamics. Some of the dynamics that I was really interested in and really moved by. You know, just how we hand over to generations and the power of education within all of those things and those conversations.
And is the father still with us?
Yes, he is. Yeah, very much so. And so he was around, you know, because we filmed. You know, William himself has done so much sort of innovative work on his house that we could no longer film in his house, which is what I wanted to do initially. But we filmed in his neighbor's house. But so Triwell and Agnes, his parents, who are depicted in the film by myself and Issa Mega, you know, we're always kind of around, sort of looking over our shoulder a little bit.
And talk about who is playing William himself.
So we had the great fortune of working with Alexa Fogel, the great casting director out of New York, and so she had a number of contacts in different countries in Kenya and so on, and so she was able to cast quite a large net to try and look for a William Kamkwamba, you know, an actor to play William Kamkwamba in you know, we looked in Europe and America a little bit, but also in Kenya and Malawi itself and South Africa, and quite quickly she came across this boy, Maxwell Simba, who just turns out to be the most terrific actor and really this incredible emotional center to the film, and holds this extraordinary sort of intellectual intelligence and emotional intelligence, and is a wonderful actor.
Yeah. So you're in a couple of interesting positions as an actor. One, you're playing somebody who's still alive, and both you and your other co-star, you get the real people sitting there back of the camera going,
Yeah,
I wouldn't have said it that way.
Yeah, no, it's great. You know, well, we were trying to be as honest and as authentic as possible, and in that sense, being there and trying to really engage with the community was really important. You know, I wanted to try and create a film that had a sort of, had an epic quality. You know, I feel like these people in this village, you know, this tiny remote village, but I feel like their lives are extraordinary. Their lives are epic. And I wanted to relate that kind of epic quality on screen. But I also wanted to feel that it was truthful, that it was authentic. And so I wanted to feel the pressure of having Triwell and Agnes and the whole community who experienced these incredibly traumatic events, you know, right there, you know, looking at us.
Was it always the plan that you play the central role in the movie as well as direct, or were you looking for other actors?
When I started writing it was in 2009, and at that point, you know, because, you know, his kid is a teenager, a young teenager, at that point I thought that I was too young, you know, to play his father. But as the years went on, you know, as I was developing the script, I suddenly started to find myself right in the sweet spot. So then I decided that it might be worth trying to try and do that as well, you know, to take that on as well.
Yeah. Well, the one thing that even outsiders know by now is that when you're a director, you're being asked about a million different things at once. And then you're also acting. How'd you deal with that?
Well, it's complicated. But, you know, I think one of the things you really need is terrific collaborators. And that's what I had. You know, I had an extraordinary production designer right from the beginning. The first person I brought on board was Tule Peak, who made the film City of God. And he flew over from Brazil to start working on the film. Dick Pope, you know, who's a sort of legendary cinematographer, came over. And Valerio Bonelli, our editor, you know, came in and worked on the film. So he was editing as we were shooting and so on. And so we had a little community there to kind of support the endeavor of all the kind of hats I was wearing.
Yeah. And just finally, do you have the real people?
Here at Sundance?
William Kamkwamba is here and, you know, having a great time. And
excellent.
And the reception to him has been so amazing. And people have really responded to having him here. So that's been great.
Okay. Well, it looks like you had your premiere yesterday at the Ray Theater, and you're returning, Monday in the afternoon, 4 p.m. at the Redstone, and Thursday you're trucking on down to the Sundance Resort. That'll be interesting. Hmm. And then next Saturday the 2nd, you're at the Big Eccles Theater, so we'll see if you... in the morning, let's see if you can pack those the 1,200 seats
yeah,
into the Eccles.
I'm sure you will.
Okay.
Yeah, that'd be great.
All right. And welcome back to Park City this time as director and actor. So
thank you so much.
Thanks for being on the Sundance Reel.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
All right.
This is Mike Kirby with Big D Construction. Utah is our home, but we build commercial structures from coast to coast. We also build homes through our Big D Signature Group. More information about Big D's commitment to our customers and employees can be found at big-d.com.
Welcome back to the Sundance Reel on the Weekend. I'm Rhett Bruff here with my co-host, John Burdick.
And in studio with us right now, Andre Horman, sorry, and Anna Samo. Their short animated documentary, Akiko Takakura. Did I get that one right?
That's the name of our protagonist.
Oh, yes. Okay, and the name of the film?
Obon.
Obon, thank you.
What is Obon? What is it?
Obon is basically the Day of the Dead festival of the Japanese.
Okay. Yeah.
So it's the day when people in Japan believe to be visited by the ancestors, by the spirits of the ancestors, and they prepare feast for them. There is food and a lot of rituals connected to this, honoring the ancestors.
Oh. What day of the year is that?
It's a festival. It's like about a week, and I think it's different in each region, but it's somewhere in August, and in Hiroshima it's around the I think the first week of August, maybe.
So in this short documentary, the synopsis of the film, for those that are listening, is the last remaining survivor of an atomic bomb attack on Hiroshima tells the story, a visually emotionally stunning story. She describes how amidst the terror and nightmare, she found a rare moment of closeness with her father. So can you talk about how you got involved with her and this film?
So I'm a documentary filmmaker. Originally, and I was in Hiroshima and Kyoto end of 2012 for 3 months, and I interviewed like many of the last Hiroshima survivors, because obviously they are very old now, and it's about time. If you want to do that, it's about time to do it now. And there I met Akiko Takakura, and she told me that that story that she found the love of her father in the midst of all that horror, and I really was moved by that and thought I would really love to do a film about that, but then it was really hard to do it with documentary tools, because there you have to have a story that's like in the present and, you know, you follow it to the future. And then I was really happy to team up with Anna and make it an anima documentary.
Okay. Have you guys worked together before?
We had a little gig together before, but it wasn't that serious.
It wasn't anything like this?
No.
Yeah. Well, we know each other since 2001, I believe.
Yes.
Yeah, and studied together, and I worked with her husband a lot.
Nice.
Can you describe, what's the style of animation that one uses to employ the tale of a survivor of Hiroshima? What is this?
So I worked, it's basically traditional 2D drone animation, all hand-drawn, and where you just draw each frame. Right. it was... I think for me it was very important that it's something connected to something that I'm doing with my hands, something very tactile. And if you would see the film, you would see that there is the story arc is somehow told by the hands. There are hands that are dirty at the beginning, hands that are burning in the middle, and hands that are being washed at the very end. And somehow it had a lot. There are hands that are broken and symbolized the broken life. So somehow, for me, it was very important to do it with my own hands and to kind of channel this emotion through my body and through my hands.
And also regarding the style, there are like many drawings of actual Hiroshima survivors, like right after the bomb blast. And we had a close look at all of these, and they have a very similar and very special style, and we kind of got inspired by that as well.
It's a combination of how I draw and of inspirations. They came from outside. On one hand, the Japanese prints, like Hokusai prints, and on the other hand, these drawings that were very strong, they all had a very, very different style. But for me, the most important was people who didn't know how to draw, who had the pencil for the first time in their life, maybe, and they were telling their stories with this pencil, and they couldn't hide behind their artistry, behind the draftsmanship. Their stories, they were like really coming out unfiltered, and those were the stories that like really they made my heart tremble, and so I was mostly inspired by those.
Yeah. How long is your film?
It's 15 minutes.
17?
15.
And so to do the animation for a 15-minute film by hand, how long were you working on this?
My average is about 1 minute per month. Per month.
Ooh.
Yes.
Yeah, Andre was laughing. Hmm. were you, in terms of creating this, were you listening did you hear all of the interviews with Akiko, all of her comments, you know, before you sat down to do the animation? Was it playing as you worked, or?
So Andre wrote the script based on the interviews that he conducted with Akiko Takakura, and I never met her before that. Uh-huh. So I had the script. I had her full interview, and I of course listened to it. And I had the sentences that we were using for the film cut out of this interview. And I was working with them. And we also had the voices of the characters of the actors that were the Japanese actors that.
They reenacted
the flashbacks, her memories, like her father and her sisters. And that was what I was listening to. And the voice of Akiko Takakuro inspired me a lot because it's a very unusual voice. It has a lot of fragility in it, a lot of very unusual intonations, at least for our Eastern ear. And somehow it was like a music that that was with me all these years, yes.
So, Andre, you said your background was in documentary filmmaking, and is this your first one where you animated? And has this given you, like, a whole freedom? You want to keep going in this direction? Or what has your experience been like as coming to this for the first time as an animated documentary?
It was my first time. We had, like, a little film before where we had, like, parts that were animated, but a full animated short film I never did before, and it's amazing for me, especially being a documentary filmmaker, because like my job usually is having an idea about how things work out, and then life gets in the way like big time, and then I have to always kind of, I don't know, react and try to find another storyline and try to, I don't know, it's way more chaotic and you have like. You have to pick in the moment, and you have to like gather material, and with that, it was for me. I felt like we have basically full control, which was amazing, and we
totally different than anything you'd ever done. Right?
Totally different than anything I've ever done, and then it was for me. It was really great to see how Anna was able to. To get in the head of Akiko Takakura and visualize her like emotions in a subjective way, which is not possible like in a documentary working style, obviously. So we are planning on more projects, and I'm really looking forward to that.
Yeah. Now I'm a little unclear if Akiko is the last survivor or one of the last survivors?
She's one of the last survivors. I think there were like around 10 people that survived the bomb blast in a.
She was like 300 or 500 meters from the epicenter. Like in this circle, there were like only 10 or 15 people who survived. And of course, there are more survivors because there were people who were kids at that moment and that were in Hiroshima. But she is one of the last survivors.
So from the epicenter, is there a way to gauge that? From where we're sitting now, where would that be, you think?
You see the trains, the transit center right there where the buses are?
Yeah, that would be somewhere like
somewhere there. She was
just lucky enough to be inside of the bank, which was a very modern building built of concrete, earthquake proof, and that's why she managed to survive. Otherwise, it wouldn't be possible. Like all people who were there, they just were wiped out.
And one thing you mentioned that struck me, you said this ceremonial, the obon, the time of the dead. This is a tradition that goes back how many years, as far as you know?
It's for centuries.
Centuries, yeah. Century, and takes place in August, and it just hit me. And the bombs of Hiroshima and Nagasaki fell in August, right?
Yes, yes. And it's also, they always put the lanterns at the end of the ceremony. They put the lanterns with fire, lit lanterns into the river. So these lanterns would guide the ghosts and the spirits back into their world. And this tradition is very strong in Hiroshima and has a very, an additional meaning because they, of course, think of all these people who are...
Yes, certainly, yeah.
All right, well, we've been talking to Andre and Anna, Anna Samo and Andre Horman, and they are the directors, producers of Oban. You can see it today at 6:15 at the Temple Theater, Monday the 28th at the Egyptian Theater at 11:45 p.m., and then Thursday the 31st also at the Egyptian Theater at 8:30. Thank you so much for being on the Sundance Reel on the weekends, and enjoy your Sundance Film Festival.
Thanks a lot for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
L.L. Bean is proud to support KPCW. The new L.L. Bean in Park City is now open on Main Street, with clothes, outerwear, and gear for time together outdoors, plus activities with L.L. Bean outdoor discovery programs. We may be from Maine, but Utah's miles of hiking and mountain biking make us feel right at home. Details at llbean.com.
And we are back, Sundance Real on the weekend. I'm Rick Bruff with my co-host John Burdick, and with us now we have the filmmaker and photographer of the documentary Toni Morrison, The Pieces I Am. It's Timothy Greenfield Sanders, and welcome.
Thank you.
Yeah. Was this, is it fair to say we can expect to see this on American Masters? Is that right?
Eventually you will. Uh-huh. I'm hoping it will also be seen in theaters and, you know, everywhere we can get it. It's a film that should be seen by everyone.
Yes. Is it, was it a film, you know, when you're making it, you know it has that slot on PBS, or did the film come first and then
it was a kind of complicated arrangement in which we had PBS in place, which was so wonderful. And then that helped us kind of, it always helps to get people when you say, you know, the film's got to be on television. But I think today with the docs doing so well in theaters, there's a whole other audience that will go get out of their houses and, you know, watch a film in a warm theater.
And this is your fourth film that you've done, and the first one was at Sundance, or fourth one at Sundance?
It's the fourth one at Sundance. I've done, I think this is my 13th film.
Oh, wow.
But I was a photographer as well, so I have a kind of a career that's, I guess, a hyphenated name and a hyphenated career.
And this Sundance different than in years past?
A lot more traffic.
Yes. We were just talking off air about that.
A lot more traffic.
How crazy it is this year.
You know, it's such an important moment for any filmmaker to be at Sundance, and you know, we're here, we're you know, patting them on the back, but it really sets your film apart, and it makes your film get the attention that you hope it will get. So Sundance is this kind of place, really, in all filmmakers' minds that, you know, I've got to get it into Sundance.
And you're here. Can you tell us a little bit about your attraction to this story and why you're telling this tale now?
Toni Morrison and I are friends for 38 years next week.
Oh, wow.
She came into my studio in 1981. I had, at the time, a little studio in the East Village. It's much bigger now. And she was smoking a pipe. And we became friends from that moment on. And I continued to take portraits of her, did her book covers. And she really was an inspiration for other work of mine. I did a series of films I called the List films. The first was The Blacklist, which premiered at Sundance in 2008. And Toni was the guinea pig for it. I came to her with this idea and said, you know, would you do an interview looking straight to camera, just talking about your life, and we're going to cut it down to 5 minutes and we're going to have 20 people doing it. And she said, yeah, that sounds interesting. And this idea had come from a lunch we had where we were talking about black divas, and Toni said, we should do a book together on black divas. You shoot it, and I'll write about it. And I thought about it, but eventually I thought maybe it would be more interesting to do just a range of African-American talent, and that would be the film. And that became The Blacklist.
And what did you, to do this film, which is about a two-hour-long film, and what did you say to her about, I want you to sit down and talk about the span of your life in front of my camera.
The first thing was to get her to agree to do it. Because for a subject of a film, it's an enormous amount of energy and time. And, you know, she had to sit for many interviews with us. She had to open her archive up to us. It's real work for the subject. And for someone as important as Toni Morrison to devote that time is a real ask in that sense. So once she agreed to do it, we formulated a plan and got in there as quickly as possible to do the first interviews, because those really set the tone of where we're going to go with this film.
Yeah, but as a friend for 38 years, I mean, that must help a lot. You know already what a pretty good idea of what to talk about.
But I learned so much as well. I mean, I was aware that Toni was an editor, but I wasn't really in depth aware. So when you start to make a film like this and you look at what she's done and the books that she published and the authors that she brought to life, in a sense, you learn so much more.
Was there any particular nugget that she mentioned that had you going, whoa, really?
You know, I think what people, when they think about Toni Morrison, they think about her as the author of Beloved, or maybe they've read a couple of books, or else they're fanatics who know every book. But they don't know that she's raised two sons, a single mother, raised two sons. They don't know about her in kind of enormous importance as a book editor, bringing black writers to the foreground and really creating in a way the literature for the black studies programs in America, just bringing authors to light that wouldn't have seen the light. So and on top of that, she was a professor. So she taught at Princeton and Harvard and Yale and Howard and, all over the place. So this is an extraordinary life. 2 hours is not enough. I wish we had, she deserves 10 hours.
And then you had some other powerful interviews in it with Fran Lebowitz and Sonia Sanchez, Oprah Winfrey. Yeah. They just obviously just wanted to get involved with the project, or...
Absolutely. This is a project in which every phone call I made, people would say things like, I'm getting goosebumps, of course I want to do it, anything for Toni Morrison. And that's all the way from, Oprah to the 25 African-American artists, fine artists, painters that I brought into the film to use their work as visuals in the film, who all said, whatever you want. So it was a kind of labor of love, really. For me, but also I think there's so much love for Toni out there.
And these interviews just really just put touches on your film that you didn't think were going to be there?
Yeah, you're talking about interviewing some of the most extraordinary people in America, in the world. Oprah Winfrey is a master in front of the camera, of course, but so is Fran Lebowitz, so is Angela Davis, Sonia Sanchez, Walter Mosley, Hilton Ailes. I mean, these are all top people in their fields.
Which one of them goes back to the earliest in her life, do you think?
They all are, I don't know exactly. I know that Fran Lebowitz and Toni go back to the 70s. They're friends quite a long time. And Angela Davis, Toni published her book when Angela was 27 or 8. She did her autobiography, and Toni convinced her to do it. She says, I think in the film, that Toni convinced me to do the book that I didn't know that I was, that I wanted to make, essentially, to write.
Is it a film is it a film for those who know Toni Morrison already and appreciate, or one for people that don't know her quite as much? Maybe all they know is maybe all she did. Beloved.
You don't need to know her work as a writer, because the film really is about her themes, and about her dedication to writing about race and writing about the Beloved was probably the most important book on slavery in the last 50 years, if not one of the most important books ever. On the subject, and there, it's not really critical that you are a fan of Sulla or The Bluest Eye or any of these masterworks. It's really that this person is so extraordinary and what she's accomplished, and you love her in this film. I mean, she really comes through as a remarkable woman. And for me, it's like an honor to know her. I feel that way.
Is she here?
She's not here. She's in New York. She doesn't travel much these days. So. She's 87 years old.
Yeah.
Probably not coming up to the snow and the altitude. Yeah,
she's not a skier.
Not going to get on the slopes.
Let's not bring it. Let's not throw her in the middle of Carmageddon.
Exactly.
So your first showing is a few hours from now, right? 2:30 in the afternoon at the Mark. And also on Monday, you're over at the Temple Theater at 6:30. And a trip down to Salt Lake on Tuesday. And then Friday, the first, you're at the Ray Theater at 9 a.m. And then your final Saturday, February 2nd, you're back in Salt Lake City.
Right.
So you're going all over the place.
Tony Morrison.
Yep.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. We've been talking with Tony. Timothy Greenfield
Timothy
Sanders.
Greenfield Sanders. Thank you.
Thank you all.
Thank you very much.
Much appreciated.
Hi, Dan Dearden here, owner of Just Right Air, sponsor of KPCW programming. Just Right Air has been advising Park City area homeowners to repair, replace, and maintain their heating and air conditioning since 2004. Details at justrightair.com.
KPCW shows are now available for podcast. Either through your iTunes or Google Play apps, just search KPCW and download your favorite public affairs show so you can listen whenever and wherever you want. From the local news to mountain money, from this green earth to the mountain life, Cool Science Radio, The Morning Mix, and Cada Domingo. KPCW Podcasts, just another way you can listen like a local.
Welcome back to the Sundance Reel on the Weekends. Nisha Gantara?
Ganatra.
Ganatra, sorry.
You got it.
I dyslexia kicking in here. our director and producer of the acclaimed series Transparent won a Golden Globe for the best television series, musical, or comedy, and received numerous Emmy nominations. Recently sold a half-hour pilot by Amy Poehler based on NBC Universal Television. She's here with her premiere. It's in the premiere categories, Late Night. And welcome to KPCW and the Sundance Reel.
Thank you.
Tell us a little about the premise of this, which is interesting that you're bringing together, sounds like you're two talented actresses from different realms of the world in this story. So Emma Thompson and Mindy Kaling, wrote. And so what's the story here?
So Emma Thompson plays Catherine Newberry, who is the first and only female late night talk show host on a major network. And Mindy Kaling, and her series has been on for about 30 years, her shot talk show, and it's hit a bit of a slump, and the ratings are in decline. And Mindy Kaling comes on as her diversity hire, as sort of the only woman in the writer's room based on Mindy's real-life experiences. And she sort of comes along and ends up inspiring each other and helping each other and save the show.
Okay. and these two actresses, they picked Emma Thompson. How did she get involved with the project?
Oh, yeah. So Mindy actually wrote it for Emma Thompson.
Okay.
She had her in mind. She and I assumed they knew each other, but it turns out Mindy did not know her at all. And she was saying she just sort of sat in her room late at night writing this movie for Emma Thompson, and imagining them. And it was sort of like, you know, fan fiction. She was just sort of writing on her own. And then luckily, Emma read it and said yes and loved it. And so then when I came on, I met Emma, and just there's no one else you could imagine in this part. Like, if there were to be a major, a female major late night talk show host, you'd know it would be Emma Thompson. So
who knows? Maybe
natural.
It'll happen,
yes,
right?
Absolutely.
After this, right?
I know. It's kind of that thing where if you imagine it, you make it so.
Yes, if you build it, it will come.
Yes. Well, you know, I think I discovered on Emma Thompson, it's not very well known for us Americans, but she did have kind of a sketch comedy background.
She did. I mean, I think a lot of people don't remember that because she's done such incredible dramatic work, but she started as a stand-up comedian, and in college she had a sketch comedy group called Footlights, which is all over YouTube, which I've watched everything now, with Hugh Laurie, and she just... It's just incredibly funny actress. And I always knew that watching her, when, especially Sense and Sensibility, you see her like just impeccable comic timing. But I think of late we've seen her just playing very serious roles. So it's really fun to see her just, you know, in her at her best, and her athletic ability with comedy and words and physical comedy and verbal comedy. She's just hard to beat.
And she wanted to get back to comedy. She was just excited to get involved with this.
I mean, I would assume there aren't that many roles written like this for her that are, you know, take advantage of her incredible comedy ability. And I think she was very excited. She showed me. I got to go to her sort of secret amazing office where you go through and she's got all these tapes in her career, and you realize, like, you just start, you know, Emma Thompson's always been on a pedestal for me. And then, like, as you meet her, and she just is so smart and so brilliant and then so kind and so wise. And she just gets to be this person that you kind of can't believe exists. And then she was showing me this footage, and I just sort of asked, can I keep these VHS tapes? Can I take this DVD? It's all for research. It's just research for your character. Right. But then I was watching it all, and we actually, some of it made it into the movie, which is great. We used some footage of her doing stand-up in 1983, and it's fantastic to see it. And the audiences were a little, I remember some people were like, was that a hair and makeup trip? And I was like, nope, that was actually Emma Thompson in 1983 doing stand-up.
Wow.
And now, her character... British or American?
British, yes, yeah.
She's British, but is the show set in America or Britain?
The show is set here in New York City, like all the late night shows. And but her character struggled to make it in England and then finally made it and fell in love with an American who was sort of her manager and a big 20 years her senior. And came to America and broke into comedy and the late night business here with his help.
Yeah. So now, Mindy be involved with it, and the writer, was there a lot of improv that was going on when you were filming that you just were like, okay, this, and Mindy was okay with it, or did it just go word for word with
the
script?
Well, I mean, every writer loves it when you change all their words.
Yeah,
they're
this
huge fans of that. But, you know, she was pretty good about it because I think she comes from comedy, so our promise was we'd always get one as she scripted it, and then you kind of can't have the reins of that many comedic actors and not let them go, you know? So the joy was, okay, we definitely got the scripted version, and then we'd sort of let them run. And some of the improvs that came up were hilariously amazing. Some of them went on, even though they were so funny, we couldn't put them in the movie.
You never can. That's the problem with
yeah.
the improv.
But a lot of them did make it in, and it was such a tight script that it just was sort of cherries and sprinkles on top of everything.
And now I know your resume has a lot of TV. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Dear White People, Brooklyn Nine-Nine, and some work in the Mindy Project. So you already knew Mindy Kaling.
Yeah, we met when I directed an episode in the Mindy Project, and it was right after Transparent sort of started getting a lot of acclaim and was blowing up. I think when we did Transparent, we thought we're making a tiny little art movie that nobody was going to care about. And no one had really heard of Amazon as a place to watch things yet. And so everything kind of, I remember even some people in the industry at the time were like, oh, that's a little web series. It's going to be, you know, maybe someone will see it. But then it sort of blew up into this big phenomenon, and it really helped open a bunch of doors to doing other TV.
Yeah. So as a director, I mean, now working on a movie.
Yeah.
is that different from TV for you?
Well, that's not, I mean, my start was an independent film. So my first project I ever directed was an indie film. And then it sort of was a journey into television. But TV sort of became more like independent film than independent film did for a while. Independent film, all the places that funded them and showed them kind of were closing down or changing or you know, just the small films that we kind of made the scene what it was in the 90s just stopped getting made. And it seemed, I was like, where did all those filmmakers go? And where's all that material? And it was HBO and it was TV and it was all these interesting streaming places. So it kind of feels like I've always worked in independent film, because even the television I do is very auteur driven and seems to be much more in that same vein, except for a couple of network shows like Brooklyn Nine-Nine and Mindy Project. They were, they had much more resources than any indie film I've ever made, which was really interesting when you're like, wow, I'm making 21 minutes of a show and I have millions of dollars that I did not have when I had to make an hour and a half movie or 2 hour movie.
Besides being a fun movie, this is also getting into issues of these two particular women, and each of them, I guess, facing kind of a different challenge. The one woman, the first woman in the writer's room, and the other woman trying to hang on to her perch.
Yeah.
As this TV institution, and they've got different, you know. So talk about what issues that you draw in 60 seconds.
And here's the challenge. Really.
Well, we have the intergenerational women, and I think it was interesting because Emma's character sort of got into it by playing the rules by the man's game, right? Like, it was sort of that generation of women that really broke the ground and broke in. Some of them did it by saying, I'm just like you. I'm just like a man. I'm not different. Don't treat me differently. And there was a sort of feeling of, I got in, I'm the only woman at the table, I'm going to close that door behind me because God knows there's only room for one of us, and I'm not losing this spot that I fought so hard to get in for. And so I think what we were wanting to show in this movie is that idea that there's only space at the table for one was a myth created by the people in power to sort of keep other people out, and that the best way to help each other rise is to open that door behind you and help the next generation of women come in and get those seats at the table so that we all rise together, rather than buying into the zero-sum game idea that, you know, if I made it, that means you can't make it. And if you come in, you somehow threaten me, because none of that is true.
Yeah. And are your stars here with you?
They are. Well, Emma Thompson is filming in London, so she couldn't make it. But Mindy Kaling is here, and Reed Scott, and Paul Walter Hauser, and Amy Ryan. John Lithgow is here. It's just been a pretty incredible.
Impressive cast.
Yes, very impressive cast.
You've had a couple of showings already, but up in Park City, let's see. You're jumping around for a couple of days. Here,
yes, I think it's today in Salt Lake City, tomorrow at the Sundance Resort. Mountain Resort.
Yeah.
And then
Tuesday at the library, and then Tuesday night at Eccles Mark on Saturday the 2nd, and Sunday at the Tower Theater.
Wow.
Thank you so much for coming on the Sundance Reel.
Thank you so much for having me.
And finishing out our show for us.
Oh, great.
Thank you.
You are listening to KPCW Park City at 91.7 and 88.1 FM in Summit County, 91.9 FM in Wasatch County. You can stream us live on kpcw.org, the KPCW app, or ask your smart speaker to play KPCW. This program, as well as all the other Sundance Reel interviews, will be on our website, kpcw.org. All right, stay tuned. We've got TED Radio Hour coming up right after NPR News.